Hello, and welcome back to AASA, the School Superintendent Association's Public Education Policy Podcast, or PEP Talk for short. I am Kat Sturdivant, the AASA Advocacy and Governance Coordinator, and your host for each episode. This month, I wanted to visit a topic we discuss a lot, perhaps foundationally, at AASA, Title I funding. How is it determined? What's its history? Who does it benefit? So to help me, I invited Nora Gordon from the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University to talk about this cornerstone of our advocacy at AASA. Nora, how are you doing today?
Great, thanks. How are you?
Let's start with some introductory information for our superintendents who are perhaps less familiar with the ins and outs of federal funding. This week, we are talking about Title I. So we've previously had an episode talking about appropriations on PEP Talk. I would like to talk to you about how education is funded at the federal level and where Title I comes in.
Well, Title I was originally Title I of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. So that's where it originated. And when you hear people talk about title funding, some of those other titles are of that same act, which in its current reauthorization is ESSA. And not all federal funding comes from that. IDEA is separate. And when you think about how those title funds, and specifically Title I, is funded at the federal level, I guess you've already covered one of the big pieces, which is appropriations. And then the other question is, how are those appropriations divided up among states or districts or schools to whatever level they're flowing down? And that happens through the formulas.
So you kind of started with a little bit of the background of Title I. What is the history of it?
Sure. So there had been, as I said, it started in 1965. It was part of the War on Poverty, President Johnson. There had been longstanding demand for federal funding for elementary and secondary schools. And you can think of several reasons why it's useful to think of a federal role in schools, even though schools are so local in our nation's history, but there are federal aims at stake. So if you're thinking about things like economic growth or socioeconomic mobility, those are reasons why federal policymakers might be interested in making sure that there's sufficient resources in every school district to facilitate those goals. Federal funding is also really the only way that you can do redistribution from richer states to poorer states. So there's a lot of redistribution that happens within states, but this is the only way to get that kind of cross-state redistribution. Given limitations on federal policy, just thinking about the Constitution, right? The education is not delegated to the federal government, it's reserved for the states. And so if the federal government wants to influence policy, the tool it really has is conditional funding. And so you need some funding if you want, you know, if you want a carrot for your policies, you need to have some pot of money. So in 1965, historically, it's pretty interesting. What came together at that moment was something that had been holding up federal funding a lot in the past was religion. And the question of would there be funding for, especially for Catholic schools and other private schools. And so this is why we see equitable services in Title I that can direct funding following the students down to the private school. And race was also a huge issue in thinking about how you would design any federal program. And 1965 is a year after the Civil Rights Act in 1964, which, among other things, prohibited agencies that discriminate on the basis of race from receiving federal funding. And so that rule comes in 1964. And then in 1965, suddenly there's a lot more federal funding on the line to make that incentive more meaningful. So that's the history of how it came about. The funds, there was kind of a bit of a regulatory fight over how the money could be used, how general should it be versus how, you know, targeted for the most economically disadvantaged kids. That was kind of a bit of a fight with the guidance. And I would say it ultimately was pretty flexible in 1965 when it was first passed. And then also in thinking about the formula was structured so that there's really something for almost every member of Congress there, or really for every member of Congress and almost all school districts, that the money is spread around. And so it's a politically popular program for that reason.
Very cool. So you have already started talking about the formula, and superintendents often hear us being the advocacy team at AASA talking a lot about the Title I formula. So how do we talk about the formula in a way that doesn't make people zone out? And what does it take to get people talking meaningfully at a high level on the formula?
I would love for you to let me know when you figure that out, because I've been wondering about these questions for some time. It's really hard to do, I think, in general, but especially when you're talking about really complicated formulas, which these are. So there are four different funding formulas for Title I, and there's a bunch of stuff in them that makes it really hard to understand how you go from the formula on paper to the distribution of allocations to different school districts. So I think in my experience of following the issue, the times when people talk more about the formula, and even then they're not so much talking about the actual formula and how they, you know, changes they would like to see, it's more of a what is up with this formula kind of take. It happens when people are looking at things that don't seem fair to them. And so some of those things might be, look at this place that I think of as richer, getting more money per kid than a place that I think of as poorer. Or look at these two places that seem demographically pretty similar, and one of them's getting a lot more money per kid than another. And how is that? So sometimes that we've seen this, I don't know if you remember, it's a bunch of reporting that Lauren Camera did for US News. This was like around the time of ESSA reauthorization. That got people talking because I think it was really kind of highlighting, looking side by side at these two districts. Why is the funding different? In ESSA, there was actually a congressional mandate for a formula report, reflecting that people are kind of confused by how are the formulas generating some of these differences, and probably some of that interest coming from the advocacy efforts from AASA and others, you know, and questions people have about number weighting or percentage weighting. And without kind of getting into that, there's just a question there in that in ESSA saying, show us how the allocation per formula child differs along all these various ways. And so NCES, you know, produced a very long report that we can link to in the show notes that shows some of these. But what's hard about this is that even when you're looking at those differences, either case by case, like in the journalistic case, or overall with these tables and tables in the formula report, or actually just in people's own experiences, which came up so much during ESSER, when suddenly people are looking at these ESSER amounts and why are they so different from district to district? Because the Title I is different from district to district because ESSER was based on Title I. So those things all get people talking, but what's really hard is to link those patterns in the data that you see to very specific aspects of the funding formulas. And this is a reason why All for Ed commissioned a report, which I wrote with my collaborator, Sarah Reber, who is at Brookings. And it was about, we wrote two pieces for them. One was explaining how the formulas work, and one was talking about which types of districts benefit from the formulas. And so I'll give you those links that you can share with your listeners.
That's almost certainly exactly why we wanted to kind of do this episode and talk about this, because a lot of people don't know how it all works. As a follow-up to that, who determines Title I funding, and what's the process by which the funding levels are determined?
You mentioned you had spoken before about appropriations, and that's the process, right? So every year, Congress will appropriate funds. Thing to keep in mind for Title I is that there are four formulas. It's called the basic grant, concentration grant, targeted grant, and education finance incentive grant. And so they're making four separate appropriations for each of those four formulas, which is kind of something to watch. in general, the formulas sound like they're going to be a lot more different than they are, I would say, in many ways. I mean, they're not the same, but they are less different than one might think. So you might care, you know, which formula is getting more or less of the funding. And after the appropriation stage, there's nothing else that's up to Congress, because after that point, the formulas, which are written in the law, so you can look them up if you want. I don't particularly recommend it, but if you want to, feel free. I would recommend you read the Alpha-Red report instead. And it, you know, sort of walks through the process. The basic grant is the simplest, most straightforward formula. So I'll kind of talk through that one briefly, where you start, you're thinking about what is the count of formula children in each district, which is essentially the count of children living in poverty. And you are going to multiply that formula count by 40% of this average per pupil expenditure in the state that is adjusted. And it's adjusted because it's averaged over 3 years and it's lagged, and it can't be very high or very low. So it kind of gets bumped closer to the national average if it's kind of an outlier in that state. And so you're going to figure out what this amount would be for each district, for each of their formula children, and then figure out how much that would cost. And it always costs more than is appropriated. And so then you go into this process called ratable reduction, where you're trying to shrink the amount that every district is getting so that you're giving out all the money that Congress has appropriated and no money that they have not appropriated. But in the process of this ratable reduction, you need to make sure that you're still following things that are in the law. And so that includes a small state minimum, where small states are guaranteed a certain slice of the pie. And it also means complying with the hold harmless, which means that the total amount of funding in any district and in any state, formula by formula, can't fall by more than a certain amount per year. And so if in the ratable reduction, some districts fall in a way that would violate hold harmless, or a state falls in a way that would violate the small state minimum, you allocate extra money to bump them up to the legal amount. But the way you do that is by lowering the amount for everybody else. And so it's this kind of iterative, nonlinear thing that makes it really, really hard to predict how much funding any one district is going to get. It is a funding of their state spending. It is a funding of local child poverty, but it's also a function of how much is appropriated and what is changing in every other district in the country.
So with it being nonlinear, what are some of the hurdles to securing funding levels?
The hurdles to securing funding levels for a given district, I mean, it's really going to depend on the appropriation, unless you're thinking about changing the formula.
How can Title I funds then be used to support public school students, and how can they not be used?
This is where I have to lead with, I'm not a lawyer, and you should have a lawyer. And I guess my takeaway here is that these funds can be used in more ways than many people think that they can be used. And part of this is because the rules have changed a lot over time. There are two types of Title I programs that you can run in a school. You can have what's called a school-wide program or a targeted assistance school. And in the beginning, in 1965, it was only the targeted assistance schools. And in those schools, you would identify individual students who could participate in Title I based on their educational disadvantage, not economic disadvantage. And then later in the program's history, the school-wide models were introduced. And now the majority of Title I schools are running what are called school-wide programs. So a lot of the rules about what can you do, it depends if you're running school-wide or a targeted assistance school. And the rules for what you can do in targeted assistance are a bit more limited than in a school-wide program. And if you think of that as kind of the old model, it's just that as guidance changes, not everyone involved in administering federal funds in every state and in every district is aware of every change in the rules. It's a lot to keep track of. So I think that there are a lot of people who are doing their best and really want to protect the funds for the students who are supposed to benefit from Title I, but may not always be aware of everything that's an option. Another piece that gets really complicating here is that these are federal rules about what you can and can't do. And some things are in the law, some things might be in regulation. Many things are in these guidance documents. They could be in a Dear Colleague letter, you know, so you can go to the Department of Education website and look at the guidance documents that they have on Title I. The school-wide guidance is a pretty useful one. And just speaking to the point I was making before about how people have misconceptions, they have a section in that school-wide guidance that is titled Dispelling Misunderstandings About Uses of Title I Funds in a School-Wide Program. Remembering, of course, a school-wide program is most Title I schools. And so in that, I mean, I'll just share one quote from it, but they say the misunderstanding is that Title I funds may be used only to serve low-achieving students. And the explanation of law is that, quote, Title I funds may be used to upgrade the entire educational program in a school-wide program school. And in doing so, all students may benefit from the use of Title I funds. However, consistent with the purpose of Title I, the reason to upgrade the entire educational program in a school is to improve the achievement of the lowest students. I recommend that guidance to your listeners, but I think the piece that I picked is the one that I hear the most confusion around.
That's
another point I would share about the guidance is that it often has examples, and there's always a tension in writing guidance with examples, right? Like, it's helpful, it makes things more concrete, but it also can have the effect of making people think if it's not listed as an example, it's not okay. And that's not the case. I encourage people to go to the source, go to the law, go to the guidance. If someone in your district or someone in your state agency is telling you that something is not permissible and you don't understand why that's the case, given what you're reading is of the federal guidance, you know, just keep pushing.
So moving into the policy side of this conversation, since 2012, something that AASA has long said is that the Title I formula is a broken one. And we've supported legislation that would make it more equitable, particularly for rural districts. So what are some ways that the Title I formula can be improved, in your opinion?
The biggest change I would want to make if I got to design a formula myself would be to have some element of redistribution based on the fiscal capacity of the state. And the Medicaid program does this, right? So for Medicaid, the federal government pays a bigger share of costs in states where income is lower. And I think this makes a lot of sense for thinking about what are the goals of Title I, just to send more funds per formula child to states that have less of their own tax base to draw on. However, going back to kind of this big challenge of what are the landmines, or, you know, how can you improve the formula? The formula you have is the devil you know. And so there is always a question with, you know, any formula change of what happens if you crack it open and what might happen. With Title I, a common criticism that I hear is that it is not sufficiently redistributive, that it's giving too much money to places that don't have very many children living in poverty. And I think there, the thing to keep in mind is that this is a formula that was written to get the votes to pass. And any formula change also needs to be written in such a way that it can pass. So probably any formula change would need to happen at a time where there's going to be a big funding increase so that you can kind of have people not lose out as you're implementing a new formula over time. But what does happen every time there's been, you know, a serious discussion of changing the formula, it's very hard to see how the money for a particular district relates to the formula because of this issue before about, you know, the rateable reduction and iterating it. And so what happens is that members of Congress request the Congressional Research Service or others to run the numbers and say, okay, you're telling me that you want to change like 0.4 to 0.35 or you're, you know, some change like that. It's pretty meaningless to imagine what that is going to mean because the whole thing is so complex and opaque. And so then they say, okay, just tell me what's this going to mean in terms of the change to the bottom line for my constituents. So that's kind of the way it's almost like this trial and error of like, let's tweak different formula elements and see what happens to the distribution of the allocations.
How often does that come up in Congress, would you say? Like that question of how do we fix this or redistribute?
You know, it's only going to come up if there's reauthorization because the formula is in the law. So this isn't a regulatory issue that you could kind of advocate for in the off season. The law, you know, we had No Child Left Behind 2001, end of 2001, beginning of 2002, and then ESSA in 2015. I mean, it can go a long time. I guess you have all the times people think maybe the law will be reauthorized and then there's a buzz of activity and it doesn't get reauthorized. So
right. Maybe this year's the year, every year.
Could be. I mean, I think the other thing, like I didn't hear a ton of talk around ESSA about the formula. And I think that might be because there were other things that people were really focusing on in the reauthorization. And so if everyone's attention is on other issues, you know, it's hard to get that. But I think you can like build it over time and be building certainly ideas and a base of support so that when there is a window, you know, you need to be ready to go with what you're asking for.
I think that's a really important add-on for this episode because we have a lot of superintendents who are their own advocates. To wrap us up, I want to ask a fun question. What is your favorite Title I factoid?
I appreciate that you shared this with me in advance so I could try to think of something fun. And in the end, what can I say? I'm an economist. It's like dorky statistics. It's not fun. I think something that people are surprised to learn about Title I often and something that I care about, you know, kind of spreading the word on is the way people talk about Title I schools. And especially journalists will talk about Title I schools and they are using it as a synonym for high poverty. It's not very accurate to use it in that way. Title I schools are not a monolith. Nearly all districts in the United States are getting some Title I. And then what those districts are doing is directing those Title I funds to their own highest poverty schools. So really what Title I schools have in common is that they are among the highest poverty schools in their respective districts. But there are some districts where you have pretty high poverty schools that aren't getting any Title I and other districts where you have Title I schools that don't have very high rates of economic disadvantage. So I always encourage journalists to sort of say what you mean and what's the problem. I mean, it can almost be used in a way that if someone's saying, oh, well, this is a Title I school, as if it faces these challenges because of Title I, whereas what you might mean is this is a school with a specific knowable rate of economic disadvantage that you could look up on the internet and say instead.
I really want to thank you for coming on and talking about this. It's so important that we have this kind of documented in a way that's really easy to understand. So I really appreciate you being able to put it into terms that are digestible and entertaining. So thank you so much for coming, Nora.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Kat.
And that's a wrap on this episode of AASA's Pep Talk podcast. We invite you to share it by using the hashtag Pep Talk on Twitter. You can access past episodes in the Pep Talk library by visiting aasapeptalk.podbean.com. And once again, thank you for joining us.